Faith and Miracles was presented by Jack Crabtree on August 7, 2006 at Gutenberg College's Summer Institute, Faith and Science. The copyright for this recording is held by Gutenberg College, Inc., 2006. Gutenberg College is a nonprofit organization, and contributions may be made at www.gutenberg.edu. This material may be copied and distributed in whole for non-commercial and educational purposes, subject to the inclusion of this introduction. All other rights reserved. A brief break occurs in the middle of the following recording. It is the result of the original audio tape switching to the second side. Technical difficulties resulted in the loss of the first few minutes of this talk.
You know, there's just so many passages here, any one of which we could talk about fairly extensively, so I want to just orient us toward these passages in a particular kind of way. And my main contention is there's no such thing as the straightforward meaning of a text. Notice when you read Galileo, you know, that's going to become an issue. He talks about the unadorned meaning of a text. I would challenge that. And I would argue that there's no such thing as an unadorned meaning of a text or a natural meaning of a text. Or a straightforward meaning of a text. Every time we interpret the biblical text, what seems natural to us in the reading of the text is utterly dependent upon what assumptions we bring to the text. With a certain set of assumptions, a certain reading is going to seem like the natural meaning of the text. But if you don't have those assumptions or don't bring those to the text, that seemingly natural meaning of the text no longer seems natural, and something else will seem natural instead. That's particularly evident in the passages, I think, that we're looking at today. If you have a certain set of assumptions about who Jesus is, what a miracle is, and what faith is, then your natural reading of these accounts is going to be one thing. If you have a whole different set of assumptions about who Jesus is, what faith is, and what a miracle is, you're going to have a very different reading of the text. So it becomes crucial then how are we supposed to view Jesus, how are we supposed to view faith, how are we supposed to view miracles. I would argue that it's going to take more than these particular texts to settle that question. You're going to have to look at the entirety of what the New Testament teaches, the what the Bible teaches about God and the nature of God, and all kinds of other considerations to finally answer those questions. And then those become the context and their orientation to these miracle stories and give you the lenses through which you will look at them. Okay, I hope that's my main contention. I hope that's clear. I want to illustrate that before we're done. But let's look at our choices here. Take Jesus, for example. There may be more choices than I have up here, but here's a major choice we have to make. How are we supposed to understand who this dude Jesus is? Is he God having taken the form of a man? Or is he a man who is God? And the difference I'm going for is, where do we throw the emphasis? Is Jesus God, but he's in man form? Or is Jesus a man, like you and me, but who has this unique standing, unique status, unique quality about him that in some significant and meaningful sense, he's the embodiment of God in a way that you and I are not? Well, both of these views would take Jesus to be God and man, so might very well fit our orthodox formulation of the incarnation. So both of them are orthodox. The question is, What's the superior understanding, the more accurate understanding of how we're supposed to look at this person, Jesus? I would argue that most Christians in American Christian culture today tend toward number one. We throw the emphasis onto his deity in such a way that we think what we're seeing on the pages of the New Testament is this unique kind of hybrid God-man where you're seeing his deity leak out all over the place in the way he interacts with people. I'm going to argue, my own personal view is that two is actually more accurate. We're not seeing God at work in this person, Jesus. We're seeing a man functioning in obedience to his creator, his father. with a unique authority that none of us share. And that's what we're really seeing. So in all these miracle stories, we're seeing a man at work, even though this is a unique man who happens to be the very image of the invisible God himself, the very embodiment of the transcendent God himself. So some things to consider, for example. I mean, early in my Christian experience, I just took it for granted that the miracles proved that Jesus was God. Until I finally noticed, well, why doesn't it prove that the prophets and the apostles are God then? I mean, if there's something about the miracles that are automatically a kind of attesting proof of deity, then you have all kinds of people that God has throughout history authorized to perform similar kinds of things, raising people from the dead, healing people, commanding demons and they leave, the same things Jesus did, disciples and prophets did, yet we don't claim they're God. So something else is going on here. And then notice in that one passage that we looked at today, the paralytic who Jesus says, which is easier to say, your sins are forgiven, or rise, take up your bed and walk. And he says to the Pharisees, so that you might know that the Son of Man has authority on earth to forgive sins, I say to you, rise, take up your bed and walk. Notice it's delegated authority that he thinks the miracle he's about to perform is going to be credentialed. It's not his deity that's being evidenced. It's his authority from God that's being evidenced. Okay, well, that's one issue. And how you land on this is going to make a big difference, how you read all of these different accounts. The other issue is the nature of faith. None of us are probably tempted to take the first one, but that's some kind of psychic ability to tap into the divine power. That's Luke Skywalker sitting by the swamp and concentrating really hard and making the spaceship levitate out of the swamp, and then he loses his concentration and it goes back in. That's not unknown. There are Christians who may very well think of faith along exactly those lines. It's a special kind of psychic focus that God wants us to have. And with that psychic focus, you can harness the power of God and do amazing things with that. Well, that's one option for what we might think faith is. Most of us know that faith means a kind of belief, so we at least stay in that ballpark. So the second option is it's a special kind of believing, and God likes that special kind of believing, and so he rewards it in a variety of ways. And what I mean by a special kind of believing is it's a kind of believing that does not involve the ordinary rational processes leading me to the belief. I get there some other way. I have a piece of knowledge, or I have a commitment to something being true, but it's against all the ordinary rational processes that I came to that conclusion. That's what's special about faith. Not unusual for us as believers to have something of the flavor of that kind of a belief. I would argue that what we believe today, in my lecture tomorrow, I'll argue that we don't have a coherent view of faith in our Christian culture today. We just have fragments of concepts that have come passed down to us through history, and we don't even pretend to try to be able to make it coherent. And this is one of the pieces, I think. Or the third one, which would be my contention, is that belief is simply an acknowledgement that what is true is true. That's belief. Now, we call it, I mean, they translate it faith, but the Greek word just means to believe or belief. And so it's giving assent to something that's true to give assent to it as true. I acknowledge that it's true. I admit that it's true. And if I admit that it's true, then it's faith. Now, the faith, the belief that we're concerned about in the Bible are about eternal things. God, the nature of God, Jesus, who he is, who we are in relationship to Jesus and God, and so on. It's not mundane, trivial things that we believe, but it's these important eternal things that we give assent to as true. And that's what we call faith. But what's different between that and two is that it's ordinary rational processes that got us there. Why do I believe that Jesus is the Son of God? Well, no man can do the kinds of things that he does unless he's the Son of God. I mean, we saw with our, I mean, if we're back there at the time, we saw what he did. I mean, did you see what he accomplished? He's no, He's got some kind of authority that the rest of us don't have. Otherwise, how did he do those things? And it's the evidence that leads us to rationally come to the conclusion, this is no ordinary man. It's empirical evidence, if you will, that brings us to that conclusion. Now, having said that, there are two levels at which you can talk about faith in the Bible. I think we talked about this a little bit in our discussion. Demons have belief, if you will, that God is one, and they respond in an appropriate way for demons. They tremble, but that doesn't do them any good with respect to their eternal standing in God's eyes, because they're lacking in one significant respect. Although they acknowledge that the truth about God is true, they don't personally, existentially, out of their own choosing, define their own being around that truth. They're unwilling to bow the knee in the appropriate kind of way to God, and that's where they go wrong. What makes faith, saving faith, in the life of a human being is that not merely that we acknowledge the truth about God or Jesus as true, but that we make an existential commitment to that truth. We're willing to define my whole existence by that truth. It's going to make a difference in what I do, what I say, how I think, how I look at the world, what I value, what I prioritize. All that stuff is going to be transformed in the light of the fact that Jesus is who he says he is, and God is up to what he says he's up to, and so on. And because I believe all that's true, I'm going to reorganize my whole life and my whole being around that truth. Well, it's that existential commitment to that truth, where I redefine my whole being, that makes me a child of God, destined for eternal life, and so on. Mere intellectual assent, even though it deserves the word faith or belief, is not the kind of belief that we're called to. We're called to belief that ends up also being this existential commitment. Okay, now let me look at some examples of how this will make a difference. Well, first of all, also how we look at miracles might make a difference in how we look at these events as well. I think we've grown accustomed to thinking of a miracle that's something that's impossible by the laws of nature, so that if God intervenes and suspends the laws of nature and does something that's impossible by the laws of nature, that's a miracle. I'm not sure that's the best way to think about it, but let me grant you that. But is that primarily what's going on in a miracle, so that God is just displaying his power, letting his power be known? Could be. Or, if you notice that in the Gospel of John, we didn't have any of that in our reading, but in the Gospel of John, the word that John always used to describe these events that we've been looking at is a sign. These are signs. And what he means by that, I think, is that these are unusual events, attention-grabbing events, events that are so unusual and so out of the ordinary that I have to be blind to miss the fact that God has pulled back the curtains and made his reality and his presence known in some kind of way. And not only that, not only is it a sign of God's presence, but it's a sign of whatever it is God wants us to understand. So, for example, if what he wants us to understand is that this peasant from Nazareth is actually the Son of Man sent into the world by God himself to be King of Kings and Lord of Lords, he does this incredibly unusual event to somehow draw attention to the fact that this man, Jesus, is somebody you have to come to terms with. It's a sign pointing to the unusual authority of this man. That's the sign nature of it. Okay, let me look at two examples here. One is the example of Peter walking on the water. I'm going to assume you're familiar with it, so I won't go into detail about it. But the part I'm particularly interested in is, remember, Peter says, "Lord, command or instruct me that I might come to you." And Jesus says, "Okay, come on, Peter." So Peter gets out of the boat and starts walking on the water, just as Jesus was walking on the water. Then it says, when he saw the wind was strong, and then they usually translate it, and he began to sink. So he He is filled with fear, says, Lord, save me. And Jesus holds out his hand to him and pulls him to himself, and they go back to the boat. And in the course of that, Jesus rebukes him for his little faith. Okay? Now, if we have certain assumptions here, that this is a use the force, Luke, situation, it's easy to read this as if somehow Peter's faith had been adequate for several meters, and then he lost concentration, and then all of a sudden, now he's sinking because he lost concentration and he's no longer has that faith, whatever that faith is. Well, that's completely implausible under completely different assumptions about what's going on here. And what's interesting is the word that's translated sank, it only occurs once in the New Testament. It's not at all a foregone conclusion that that's the appropriate way to translate that. Because what that says in our own American idiom is, you know, the dude's sinking into the sea, into the lake. But it seems entirely plausible to me that Matthew is using the word to simply say he began to be engulfed in water. Well, that would happen if you were walking on the water and a strong wind came up and was creating high waves. I mean, what's likely to happen except that those waves begin to batter against you and get up to your waist and maybe up to your chest or whatever. What is Peter being rebuked for? Getting wet? Or fearing? And I would argue that what he's being rebuked for is his fear. In fact, not sure it's that account, but yes, I won't comment on it because I'm not sure it's that account. But I would argue that he's being rebuked for his fear. And why is he being rebuked for his fear? I mean, he's just walked 50 yards, 20 yards, 10 yards on top of the water, and a little wind and wave come along, and all of a sudden he's going to drown. I mean, what? He's completely lost perspective. If God has given you the grace to not sink for the last 10 yards, a wave's going to make a difference? Why are you afraid, Peter? And I think that's where the rebuke is coming from. He wasn't sinking. He wasn't going to drown. He wasn't going to fall into the lake. He was only afraid that he was, or afraid that he was going to be swamped or something like that. Now, what is my point in all this? My point in all this is you might be tempted to say to me, you're just tweaking your understanding of the passage. You're just reinterpreting the passage. You're retranslating the passage. That's not straightforwardly what the passage says. And my rebuttal is, well, there isn't anything that the passage says straightforwardly. And if you don't buy that, then you're not going to buy anything I'm saying here. But my contention is, it depends on what assumptions you bring to the reading of this event, what is going to seem reasonable, plausible, natural, and the right way to understand it, and the right way to translate it. But there isn't anything in the text itself that demands this be the Star Wars scenario. It's only if we become acculturated into thinking along those lines and being comfortable with that perspective that it seems more natural to take the text that way and to translate it that way. Okay, look at the other one I want to consider is the event that is in both Mark and Matthew in your reading about the disciples. The man brings his son, his demon-induced epileptic son, to Jesus. To the disciples, and ask the disciples to command the demon, and they attempt to do so and are unable to do so. And Jesus comes back, rebukes them for the littleness of their faith, and then the man approaches Jesus, and Jesus ends up commanding the demon, and the demon leaves. That event. And at the end of that, when they ask him privately, why couldn't we do this? He says, this sort of thing comes out only by prayer. Okay, how are we to understand that? With a certain set of assumptions, it's easy to read it as if performing a miracle takes a certain intensity of faith. That if you believe and believe with the right sort of intensity, then you get things done. Or in this case, if you believe and practice and engage in the practice of prayer in the right sort of way, then it gives you the power that you can perform a miracle. You could easily read it that way. Many Christian traditions read it in something like that, that way. There's a whole nother way of reading this passage, it seems to me. And that is to recognize that neither the disciples nor Jesus have the power to command demons. Disciples can't command demons and Jesus can't command demons. Jesus can be, can command, and God has the power to, or let me put it this way, to boot demons out. Jesus does not have the power to boot demons out. God has the power to boot demons out. Jesus can be delegated with the authority to command demons, knowing that his Father is going to boot them out. But Jesus has no power to boot them out. And certainly Jesus' disciples have no power to boot them out. This event happens after a mission that the disciples have been sent on, where Jesus delegated to them the authority to command demons. So they've been commanding demons for weeks, and the demons have been leaving, have been being booted out. Here they are. Jesus is up on the Mount of Transfiguration. They're alone. This man comes desperately wanting the demon to be booted out of his son. He comes to the disciples and pleads with them. The disciples are simply thinking, well, we were doing it a couple weeks ago. Okay. I mean, sure, let's try it. They try to command the demon and nothing happens. When Jesus comes down the mountain, he rebukes them for the littleness of their faith. Well, why? The evidence suggests that they've done it in the past and it's happened. What's inadequate about their understanding of things? Where's this littleness of faith that Jesus sees in them? Well, it seems to me the littleness of faith that he's responding to is that the clue to me that this is what's going on is when they ask him privately, why couldn't we do it? And he says, this sort of thing, they mistranslate it. They often translate it this kind, as if it's a species of demons that's sort of immune to normal commands and you need to pray also. I don't know, I'm not sure where that comes from, but it doesn't have to be translated kind. That's an insertion in the translation. This sort of thing happens by prayer. Well, what is he saying? I think what he's saying is, you guys have completely distorted what's going on. You guys have completely have a distorted understanding of what you've been doing for the past several weeks. Did you think you had the power to boot those demons out of people? You never did have the power to boot demons out of people. I delegated the authority to you that has been delegated to me from the Father to go out and command demons, and the Father made a commitment to boot the demons out at your command. But you didn't have the power to do that. You can't do it at your discretion, as if this power resided in you and was subject to your will. That's never been the case. I think that's what he means by you of little faith. In a context like that, you of little faith means you of faulty understanding, you who don't really get it, who don't really see how this whole thing works. So he rebukes them for their faulty understanding, and says, you have to get reoriented. You have to get clear here. It's only by appealing to the Father, who does have the power to do these sorts of things, that these sorts of things can happen. You can't do them. Okay, we start a little late, but we're a little long, so I'll leave it at that for now, and I'm sure we'll have an opportunity later in the day for any questions that might have arisen.
Jack, this probably is calling for pure speculation, so speculate away. On your Jesus, a man who is God, I know one of the things that I hear around the study center a lot is Jesus and the Father have the same Social Security number, which is sort of a way of, you know, saying that there's this identity. goes beyond merely that Jesus' will is reflects God's perfect will, because when I get upstairs, presumably my will also reflect God's perfect will, but I will not be God in the same way that Jesus is God. And I'm wondering how you would articulate the nature of that identity beyond the fact that his character perfectly reflects God's character and his authority is he has, I presume, all the authority of God or a large proportion of the authority of God to the extent that it applies to the physical, to the created universe. He definitely has more authority than I do. Is there something else that, because God could also give me that authority, he wouldn't be very smart to do that, but he could, so I could have God's character, and he could give me that authority too. Sometimes at the study center, the discussion is, you know, did Jesus have to be God? Well, maybe in some respects he did, but in terms of authority, God gave the apostles a temporary authority to heal people and that kind of thing. So presumably he could have given any man that he chose the authority that he gave Jesus. So if Jesus is not necessarily unique in his having a godly character, and he's not necessarily unique in having godly authority, what gives him the identity with God?
Well, there may be more than this, but I would argue that the authority that Jesus has is not the kind of authority that I could ever have. In that, yes, a prophet can have authority, an apostle can have authority, God can give certain kinds of authority to other people and not have them be God. But I think whatever this authority is that Jesus has been granted, it's the authority in effect to be God himself embodied in flesh. I could only speculate. What I don't know is, here's the crucial question. To be God in human form, does it mean that God's will is so mapped onto the human will of Jesus that what Jesus, the human being, wants is what God wants? Pluto, move over, or you know, something. Universe, go 3 feet to the right.
Is red.
Yeah. Yeah, I have no problem with that. That may very well be what it means eventually, if not now. The only problem I have with that is that Jesus, who walked among us as recorded in the New Testament, is described as having a distinct will that he needed to submit to the Father. Not my will, but your will be done, he said in Gethsemane. So, are we to carry that all the way into eternity? So that when he is ruling with every enemy as a footstool under his feet, and he is King of Kings and Lord of Lords over the entire universe, is he still running the universe in relationship to the transcendent creator God the Father, not my will but your will be done? That would make sense to me. In which case, that the authority that belongs to Jesus is not simply a matter of he has discretion to do whatever he wants, and whatever he wants is what God wants. If not that, then it gets difficult for me to understand and define exactly what does it mean to have the very authority of God himself in human form. And I don't have a good answer to that, but it clearly seems to be the perspective of the apostles, that he's unique in that he's actually the embodiment of the nature, character, and authority of God himself, the transcendent God himself. And I will never be that and could never be that.
Do you have any thoughts on modern miracles in comparison to how they happened in biblical times?
Is it at the heart of your question whether they're happening? Are you...
No, not really. I guess a little bit.
Because in terms of the how, I imagine if they're happening, they're happening the same way they always have. Is that, yeah, God in his power and his authority is just making happen unusual things.
Yeah.
For me, the more problematic question is, are they happening?
Yeah.
And
sure.
I'm not in a position to tell God what to do. I can't rule out the fact that he could perform a miracle akin to the miracles he performed in the pages of the New Testament. Mm-hmm. I'm dubious, I'm skeptical for three reasons. One, I've never seen any. Two, I think I have seen enough of, say, the charismatic movement and the reports of miracles in the charismatic movement that it makes me skeptical that they are seeing any miracles either. And thirdly, in the New Testament, there's a very particular role that the signs play to credential the Messiah and to credential the apostles. What role are they playing today? There are people who, if these miracles are happening, you could argue, well, God is credentialing the ministry or the teaching of this particular Bible teacher. But the problem I have there is, but God wouldn't be and shouldn't be credentialing because he's not even giving the same message as the Bible. I mean, he's contradicting Jesus and the apostles. So why would God credential a message that is in contradiction to Jesus and the apostles? That doesn't make any sense to me. So it makes me all the more skeptical that what I'm seeing is, you know, what you're seeing is not what's actually happening. Let me just give you one example. When I was just out of college, I was an intern at a Baptist church up in Salem. And I was in charge of the college group, and we had coming to our college group a young woman who wasn't in college. She actually lived in a nursing home. She was severely diabetic, had other physical problems as well, and had the most serious emotional problems I've ever seen in my life. If there was anything that fit the description of an emotional black hole, this woman was it. I mean, just she craved affirmation and sought it wherever she could because she had this very, very deep personal emotional need. Catherine Kuhlman, probably several generations back, was a famous faith healer back in the last generation. She was having a healing crusade in Portland, and this young woman was taken up there to this crusade. Catherine Kuhlman got a word of knowledge that there was someone who's going to be healed of their diabetes. She decided that word of knowledge applied to her, so she was going to discontinue her insulin because she was healed. She went up the next day, and in front of thousands of people, bore witness, testified to the fact that God had healed her of her diabetes, just as Catherine Kuhlman had said through the world of knowledge. She had thrown her insulin away, and she was healed. Well, as far as thousands of people know, they'd seen an incredible, fairly remarkable miracle. But I'm the one who went to the hospital when she was in a coma because she had thrown her insulin away. I mean, I'm the only one that knows that she wasn't healed. So oftentimes, you know, people will say, well, okay, yeah, but there's, you know, thousands of reports of these miracles. If only 10% of them are true, there's something going on. Well, that's true statistically. But it's very, very plausible to me that none of them are true. Particularly when you dial in all the factors that go into that. Let me, one other story that was very helpful to me. Years ago, somebody lived here in the house who went to a healing weekend that the Vineyard Movement had early in their history. And, he was sort of intrigued by the healing that was going on in the Vineyard Movement. And so we went to this weekend. I was very anxious to talk to him when he got back to see what he had seen and see what he observed. So we went out for coffee. And I said, okay, so did you see any miracles this weekend? Oh, yeah, there were just hundreds of them. I said, okay, well, did you see any? Did you see any personally? And he said, yeah, well, my friend did. And this is literally the way the conversation went. It was very striking. I said, oh, okay, well, what did your friend see? Well, this woman came without any toes on one of her feet, and they prayed over her, and she grew toes. Well, that had my attention because you don't just naturally get over a toeless foot like you get over a cold. Okay, that could be a miracle. So I said, okay, now let me get this straight. Your friend saw this woman with a foot that it didn't have any toes on it, and then he saw after someone had prayed for her this foot with toes on it. His response was very telling to me. He said, oh, yeah, I mean, he must have. And the reason that was so significant is because in reporting to one another, we often report better than we actually heard, because we make certain assumptions about what the person is saying to us. I mean, our assumption is, well, why would he tell me that this woman grew toes on her foot if he didn't see it? It must have been true. But actually, my friend had never asked him whether he had seen it, so he doesn't really know whether the friend was passing on hearsay or whether the friend was an eyewitness. He just assumed the friend was an eyewitness. So I went within about 5 minutes in our conversation from there were hundreds of miracles to somebody said somebody grew toes. I mean, that was just really incredible to me. One other event, when I was in college, I went to a Christian Jesus Freak commune where we had a Bible study, and somebody stood up and spoke in tongues. I had been studying some Greek when I was in college. As we were leaving, two people in front of me were talking to each other, and one of them said to the other one, that sounded like Greek to me. Well, as a matter of fact, it didn't even resemble Greek at all. But this person said it sounded like Greek to me. Well, I just start thinking about that. What is the other person going to go home and say to someone? In all likelihood, what they're going to do is say, I was at a Bible study last night, someone spoke in tongues, and somebody who knew Greek told me that they were speaking in Greek. Because why would somebody say it sounded like Greek if you didn't know whether it sounded like Greek? It's a very natural, innocent assumption to make, but it's false. I mean, I happen to know that it was false. So when those stories get passed on from one person to the next person to the next person, you get this impression that there's all these incredible miracles going on out there, when the truth is, if you were to go back and be an eyewitness to the event, you didn't see anything of the sort. Nothing like that was happening. So that's why I'm skeptical of miracle reports today, as I think I understand some of the dynamics that...
Are there any scientific studies of miracles, by any chance, out there? Just to correlate to the topic.
Yes. Well, the scientific community doesn't accept them, so you know, they're not science, whatever they are.
What about reports of tremendous healings from places in Africa or South America? Like, at school, there was, I never checked this out, which I probably should have, but there was news of an event circulating where they were going to, like, play this film about this guy that had been raised from the dead in Africa. And I never did any research. I was just like, whatever, I don't have time to look at this. But, I mean, I've read accounts of amazing healings, which would seem to be miracles. How do you address those?
I think it's the same thing as what goes on here. It's rumors and hearsay and reports and stories. Correct me if I'm wrong, Earl, but didn't... We were in Africa last summer, and I was asking, I don't know if you were there or not, but I was asking Moffat and Doreen, our host. So we often hear reports of all these incredible miracles going on in Africa. Are you aware of any of them? And do you remember their response exactly? Or? No. Or you may not have been there.
No, he doesn't.
You make one. But as I recall, they said, well, no, we've never seen one. And I think Doreen told me one story that she heard that she just didn't know what to do with. But they had never seen any themselves and were not really aware of these rampant miracles happening.
This might be a really obvious question, but could you remind me of why we should believe in the miracles that we're reading about in the Bible? Along the same lines of what you're saying right now? Because it sounds like an account of an eyewitness. We weren't there. There's some similar threads there that I was hoping you might be able to...
Well, notice in all the examples I gave, none of them were accounts of eyewitnesses.
Mm-hmm.
It was all hearsay.
Okay.
And it could be identified as hearsay. To counterbalance that, Thomas Reid, the Scottish common sense philosopher, argues that one of the principles of common sense is what he calls the principle of credulity. Is that it, Charlie? The principle of credulity. And what he's saying is that it's just sort of hardwired into us, built into human intelligence itself, that we
we find ourselves open to expanding the horizons of our experience by accepting the testimony of other people about what their experience is. I mean, otherwise, our knowledge would be much poorer if we didn't draw on what other people said they experienced in order to build our picture of the world and reality. I mean, notice children would know nothing. You know, their parents tell them something and say, nah, I don't think so. I doubt it. I mean, you're my old man. Forget that. I mean, they get there eventually, but if they were born that way, they wouldn't form any knowledge of reality in the world. So it's just built into human intelligent self to facilitate coming to know the world through the testimony of other people. So once again, our prima facie conclusion that we reach when we hear an eyewitness testimony is to believe it. We only disbelieve it when something's not right about it, when it doesn't fit, when it's inconsistent with our worldview, something, the red lights go on, we go, I don't know what's going on here, but that doesn't ring true to me. Then we become skeptical. But we're not skeptical first and then have to have it proved to us. We're ready to believe it unless we have some reason to be skeptical of it. That's how normal human intelligence works.
I don't like that, how that, it doesn't, I mean, say your grandparents are missionaries or something, and they come back, to, you know, you trust them, either your grandparents, whatever, and they come back with all these gnarly stories, you know, we prayed for this person for malaria, and he was healed the next day. I mean, that's an eyewitness account. Just, my question is like, how are we to believe the eyewitness accounts of the gospel writers?
Well, see, an eyewitness account from somebody I trusted would weigh that really heavily.
Okay. So you're saying that it doesn't rule out?
No, not at all. No. It's hearsay that I'm concerned about that gets distorted through telling. An eyewitness account from someone who is there and can tell me exactly what they saw, and I can ask them questions, mm-hmm. and I can interrogate them. Now, occasionally you might have an eyewitness testimony, an eyewitness who you can interrogate. And what they initially gave you as the interpretation of what happened doesn't stand up to interrogation. That is, you'd say, okay, I now see what you saw. I would interpret what you saw differently than you do. And that's okay. But we do have a problem in the Gospels, in the Gospel accounts. And Jesus was fully cognizant of that when he said to Thomas, you believe because you've been able to see the prints in my hands and in my side? Good. Blessed are those who believe even though they can't see. I mean, Jesus is saying basically, it's going to be hard. If you had a hard time and you've seen me risen from the dead, imagine how hard it's going to be for people come along later. That's true.
I'm still confused about the passage in one of the Bible verses that with the healing of the boy, and he was saying something about that the evil spirit can come out because the disciples, this kind only comes out through prayer, and fasting in some translations, and I forgot. Right. I'm confused on why he said that.
Well, I personally don't think the fasting is there. That's in some texts, but it's not it's not represented by the majority or the best text, I think. By the best reconstruction of the text, I should say. So I think it's just, these things only come out by prayer. And I don't think he means the practice, the ritual, the technique of prayer. I think what he's saying is, very simply, you can't bump a demon out of somebody. Only God can do that. And you got to ask the Father. You've got to appeal to him and ask him to do it, because that's the only way it's going to happen. Does that answer your question, or?
Technical difficulties resulted in the loss of the remainder of this talk.